This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We're going to look at a couple of aspects of the war in Syria. In our first segment, we'll talk about the fact that Turkey has just sent troops into that nation. This, of course, is a NATO country, one of the most impressive militaries in the world. They've actually put boots on the ground in Syria. And we're going to talk with trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about why. What are they trying to accomplish? And how might this change the game in that war? In our second segment, we'll look back at the fact that Russia had just used an Iranian base to launch airstrikes in Syria. Iran isn't in the habit of letting foreign powers use its military facilities. In fact, this was the first time since the Iranian Revolution brought the Ayatollahs into power in 1979 that it has done so. We'll talk with trumpet writer Callum Wood about why. In our third segment, we're going to get away from the world of geopolitics and explore the wonderful world of the deep sea. Some recent discoveries illustrate just how marvelous the depths of the ocean are and just how little we know about them. And I'll conclude the program by talking about the fact that love isn't always hugs and cuddles. According to wise King Solomon, sometimes it actually means wounding someone. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The war in Syria continues to get more complicated. Last week, Turkey sent its military into the fray, special forces, artillery, tanks. It's the first NATO boots on the ground in that country. We talked about this a bit last week in our Friday Week in Review program, but I've brought trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall back to tell us more about what's happening there. We have him here via Skype from our office in Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So this has been going on for years in Syria. Why now? Why did Turkey take the plunge and send its troops in?
It is a very interesting question because the United States has asked Turkey to get more involved for a long time in the fight against the Islamic State. The Islamic State is the main enemy or enemy number one for Russia, they say, for Iran. The Syrian dictator says Islamic State's number one enemy. Turkey says the Islamic State's number one enemy. And yet all of those other countries have other interests inside the Syrian battle arena.
Right. You would think that if all of those countries were, in fact, that opposed to the Islamic State, if the Islamic State was, in fact, enemy number one, it would be a blot on the ground by this point.
Right. Russia says they want to attack the Islamic State. And then the airstrikes for the first 6 months, only 10% of them, Russian airstrikes in Syria, target the Islamic State. Then you have Turkey that are saying that they want to defeat the Islamic State. And yet, what do? They're propping up the rebels in the fight against Assad. And the rebels are only fighting against the Islamic State when they have to.
But so the Islamic State is kind of the pretext du jour for getting involved in Syria. Give us a sense, and you talked about this a bit last week, but Turkey's real interest and their real target in getting into the country.
Right. So Turkey's interest and what they're most scared about is the way that the Kurds have been gobbling up territory from the Islamic State. It's interesting. Back in 2014, when the Islamic State was created, they were created in the vacuum created by the withdrawal of Assad from his country, from the north and from the east. He withdraws because he can no longer take care of it. There was an uprising against him. He withdraws back to his population centers. And then you have two strong groups that come out. You have the Islamic State and you have the Kurds that started to become a strong fighting force. They have been the most effective fighting force against the Islamic State in Syria. They have been the group that has been fighting against the Islamic State. They have been the group that has been backed up and supported by the United States with weapons and materiel, one of the groups in the fight against the Islamic State, and they have been very successful. So much so that almost the whole southern border of Turkey is right now controlled by the Kurds, apart from a tiny sliver of about 50 or so miles where the Turks sent their ground forces in across the border. Back on August 13, it looked like the Kurds were going to take the very area that the Turks ended up taking on their day one of their ground incursion. So taking from the Islamic State. So the Islamic State was in this one last pocket on the Turkish border. The Kurds were going to take it. Turkey says, no, we can't have that. And finally, that's the motivation to get them involved, to stop the Kurds from creating this huge... Basically, a quarter of Syria would be controlled by the Kurds if they let them do this.
So just trying to get to the heart of what Turkey is after here. You're looking at Syria, that the three main political entities there, the Assad regime, the Islamic State, and the Kurds. From Turkey's perspective... This is kind of like three bad options. Who do they want governing
right.
Syria?
Well, yeah, there is a fourth option, and that is the different rebel groups. They were the initial ones that started the uprising back in 2011 against the Syrian regime. A lot of the Syrian defense forces of Assad, they defected and they started to create their own militias. And they occupy that territory closer to Western Syria, south of Turkey, and Turkey has been supporting them. So Turkey, that's their player in the game, if you like, those rebel fighters that do have a sizable army. If you add up all their troops, it's something around 70,000 people. So they have quite a force. And they are wanting that group to have more of a say in the future of Syrian leadership. So by Turkey moving in there, they are essentially providing a safety and an umbrella where these Syrian rebel fighters can train. They're providing a safe haven that they can retreat to as well. And they give legitimacy at the negotiating table eventually for the leadership of Syria to this group that, as far as anyone else was concerned, they didn't have a real unified voice. Turkey's hoping to unify the rebels against Assad by moving in there, as well as ensuring that the Kurds don't make gains along his southern border.
There's a lot of moving pieces in this, and I'd like to try to separate some of these issues, but just looking at it from the standpoint of these different agents that are operating in there, we have Iran, we have Russia, we have Turkey now, we have the Islamic State, we have the Assad regime. Do we have a sense of where the deck is being stacked and who may end up out on top? Is it these rebel forces that you're describing? Is it another one of the occupying forces in there that, right, that could take over?
That's a good question. I think what we're seeing here is an aligning of interests between the United States, Russia, and Turkey. I say this because Russia was fully involved and fully informed with the decision of Turkey to enter troops into Turkey, and they were okay with it, even though they have been at odds with one another. We've talked a lot about how Russia is aligned with Iran in propping up Assad, and that is true, and it was more true at the very beginning, because Russia probably thought that they could work with Assad. They could still maintain their bases, they could still maintain the Syrian regime, but maybe get rid of the leader. But what they've seen is, even though Russia has helped out Assad so much, he has refused to budge at the negotiating table with any of these other groups, with the Syrian rebels, and Assad has said, I'm not leaving. And Russia, in fact, couldn't care less if Assad leaves, as long as their interests are maintained inside Syria. So bringing Turkey into it kind of puts a little bit more pressure on Assad, because Russia... even though Russia has been supporting him, they could at some point say, well, hey, we are the ones that are in charge here, and you can participate in a transitional government, but at the end of the day, you're out. Turkey, for the longest time, has said, we want Assad out. He's our enemy. And yet 2 weeks ago, just after discussions with the Russians, they said, we'll accept him as part of a transitional government as long as he leaves eventually. And that's what the Russians were looking for, so that they can have this united front, probably get some international pressure on Assad to leave. And the loser that I foresee, and even Bible prophecy foresees in this situation, believe it or not, is Iran. The one place that they're going to lose out in the Middle East is Syria. We know that in Bible prophecy, that Iran is not going to be aligned with Syria eventually.
This has really been what's been driving our analysis of Syria for all this time. And the whole time that this pressure has been there against Assad, we've been looking for this to be the fissure that divides Syria from Iran, because he is very much an ally with Iran. But the timetable has been so much longer than what we expected. But are we to the point where we are getting to more Assad is about to go?
I don't know if that'll happen immediately. I think there is going to have to be a little bit of time to really make Iran, the Iran and Russia angle, or make them split a little bit further before Assad is forced to leave.
Turkey is pressuring the Kurds. This does put more pressure on Assad.
Oh, for sure, it puts more pressure on Assad. And it's not just, you mentioned at the very beginning, but this is a NATO nation joining the fight. NATO has a lot of different clauses when one of its members starts to fight in a war and is being an attack. That a lot of the time, you'll expect other allies to come on board to help you out with that. And
let's talk about this and just break this down a little bit. I know that the United States apparently had no idea that Turkey was going to do this. What does this tell us, first of all, about the relationship between the United States and Turkey?
Well, it shows that Turkey is willing to use the United States as long as possible, but whenever its interest is diverged from the United States, then they're out the door. And that's what we're seeing across the board. The United States is used by the Kurds, by Iran, by the Turkey, as long as their interests are being upheld, they're happy to take weapons from them. And then once their needs and wants diverge, the United States is out. And the very fact that Vice President Biden and the Obama administration was shafted completely by Turkey. He was flying on a plane to meet with Erdogan. And when he arrives, what does he know? That their ally, the NATO ally, has sent in ground forces across the border and couldn't even wait to discuss it with the Vice President of the United States. That should be a big wake-up call to the United States. They don't have a friend in the Turkish regime anymore.
Other NATO nations, really looking at Europe and Europe's interest in Syria, how does Turkey's action impact that relationship?
Right. So that the conglomerate of nations that's been most affected by the Syrian civil war, apart from the Syrians themselves, has been Europe, because this is the cause of the migration crisis. And Europe, as we talked about before, has done deals with Turkey to stop the flow of migrants. So they have to kind of work with Turkey to get some type of agreement to ensure that continues. So they're not going to come on too strong against the Turks for doing this. They have said that they support their incursion. They don't want them to attack the Kurds. They want them to attack the Islamic State. That's at least what Germany has said at the moment. But you had the Bulgarian prime minister come out a couple of days ago, and he said that the Turkish armed forces have probably prevented a probable new migration wave of 2 million people with the Euphrates Shield operation. So he's saying that by Turkey going into Syria right now, they have prevented 2 more million migrants coming into Europe. So they're obviously getting support from some European nations for this action. One of the desires that Turkey's had since for a couple of years, and the United States has not supported it because the United States is trying to deal with Iran, was the creation of a safe zone in northern Syria, whereby a lot of the refugees could come, the ones displaced people from Syria could flee the fighting, they could go into this safe zone, they'd be protected by NATO forces, there would be a no-fly zone over the top, protected by the Americans, no one would have to come into Turkey, therefore nobody would have to come into Europe. Why can't we create this safe zone? Well, Iran did not want a safe zone because it means that all the rebel fighters that Iran is fighting against with the Syrian regime, well, they'll have somewhere to go to as well. And what this is essentially creating is Turkey is in there creating their safe zone right now. So that's why the Bulgarian prime minister is coming out and saying that this is stopping migrants coming across, 2 million more, because now they'll have somewhere to stay inside Syria. And Europe, whether they like Turkey or not, they're going to have to agree with them. They are saving them from 2 million more migrants.
Definitely alignment in the European and Turkish interests in this situation. I hope that this doesn't divert us too far from the direction that we're going in the conversation right now. But I'm just curious, how much did the failed coup in Turkey increase Erdogan's power and make him likelier? How much is that influencing his decision to say, yeah, let's go ahead and send in the troops?
Well, there is a lot of people, a lot of commentators that are saying that this was a move to show that he is still in full control of his military. He can wage ground war in another country, even though some of the people, some of the leadership in the military are out. No, Erdogan is not strengthened and not weakened necessarily by the coup at all.
So just to finish the thought, we know from biblical prophecy there is going to be an alliance ultimately between Turkey and Syria, short-lived as it will be. How might this play into that prophecy?
I don't think right now that Turkey is expecting to have a full-blown relationship with the Syrian government, wherever, however it comes out. Like, I don't think that's their game plan. They have their initial needs right now. Prevent the migrants, prevent the Kurds from being strengthened there. But when you have troops on the ground inside another country and you might have the support now of Russia, two of the big players in Syria, they might start going for a little bit more, putting more pressure on Assad to leave. Bible prophecy is like, we've put a lot of weight on the Syrian crisis being one of those issues that completely changes the relationships of alliances in the Middle East. Nobody is talking about Syria and Assad ever falling out of the hold of Iran. Nobody's doing that. And yet we can say that dogmatically. And that's why we're, as you said before, we're looking into every single detail of the Syrian crisis, because back in 2011, the editor-in-chief wrote an article, "How the Syrian Crisis Will End." I mean, you couldn't write, no one out in the world can write that article today, still, 5 years in.
And everything in that article is still in play.
Yeah, everything in that article is very much still in play. And we harp on it so often on the program here so that listeners, when it does turn out just the way Bible prophecy says, then they'll remember that we've been harping on it for 5 years straight.
It is really interesting to look at the way that this situation has unfolded in light of what seemed to be a fairly clear-cut case back in 2011. You know, the division between, okay, Assad's out and Assyria separates from Iran and so on. But the way that it has come to include Russia and Turkey and Iran and European interests, the way that they've all collided in this space, that you could see the ramifications of this actually playing out in several ways that we didn't anticipate in the time, and yet that are still consistent with the biblical prophecies regarding that whole geographic space and these two competing interests in the Middle East, the way that that collides with Russia, the way that that collides with the European Union. Fascinating situation to watch. We really appreciate you keeping your eye on it and just trying to stay on top of all of these details and developments as they unfold. Definitely something that we need to continue to watch very closely, and we will continue to look to you to help us with that.
I'll also have an article up hopefully this week, maybe Thursday, up on trumpet.com that will kind of explain what we've talked about today if it was a little bit confusing for our listeners as well.
I definitely feel like you helped us a lot to understand the situation. We do appreciate your time. You can watch for that article online at thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Brent.
No problem.
The voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
On August 16th, Russia bombed the rebel-held city of Aleppo. What made this especially unusual was the fact that the Russian bomber had taken off from Iran. We've talked about this incident on this program and on the Trumpet Daily program. This was the first time since the 1979 Iranian Revolution that Iran allowed a foreign power to operate from one of its air bases. And to learn about why this is significant and what has happened since that time, we're going to turn to trumpet writer Callum Wood. We have him here via Skype from Australia. Hello, Callum.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we're glad to have you. Maybe you could just give us some details of what happened here and why this was so unusual.
Okay, well, The news report came out pretty much straight after this happened, especially because of the fact that this bombing was a lot heavier than those we've seen in the past. We know that Russia has been bombing, running its bombing campaigns in Syria for a long time now, and this one was particularly noteworthy. The New York Times, for instance, when it ran its article, it had a quote from a doctor working in Aleppo who said that these bombings, they were really intensive and massive. And the reason for this was these Russian bombers, they were carrying a larger than usual payload. And so they're obviously able to drop a lot more munitions and bombs down on the people there in Aleppo and in a couple of other provinces in Syria. The reason for this was these planes, they didn't have to use as much fuel, so they could instead put more of that weight into bombs and such. And the reason for that is because they were flying, as you said, out of Iran and not out of Russia, effectively cutting perhaps 1,000 miles off their flight time. And this is a huge turning point for Russian-Iranian relations, because it's the first time that Iran has let anybody whatsoever launch operations, military operations, from an Iranian airbase. Even that goes right back to 1979, the Iranian Revolution. Nobody has had this opportunity like Russia has. And even before that, during the days of the Shah, America really tried hard to build that military connection. And even then, the Shah was very opposed to American influence and letting them put their military in his country. And so we see this as just a huge turning point here, and it points to a dramatic change in the relationship between Russia and Iran, and also perhaps a turning point in the Syrian civil war.
So you wrote an article about this. It's on thetrumpet.com. It's called Russia and Iran, the Middle East Axis of Evil. To see this kind of collusion taking place between Russia and Iran is really interesting. It could be significant. Maybe you could give us an idea of what each of these two powers had to gain from making this kind of a bold statement through the cooperation that they had here.
Yes, well, a lot more was gained than simply a shorter flight time and more ease with bombing. And there's certainly one theme that benefited both of these nations. Both Iran and Russia are looking to establish themselves as a viable alternative in the Middle East to the United States. Now, for Russia, I mean, this is a huge poke in the eye for America. They have managed to have a military presence in Iran, sending these bombers out to Syria, something that the United States has never been able to do. And it just helps to cement their position. We know that the Russians have been increasingly involved in Syria and have worked feverishly to build their relationship with Iran, with the recent military purchases that Iran's made on those anti-aircraft missile defense systems and such that are now set up at Fordow nuclear facility. We see Iran's really built this relationship up. And so now to have this historical moment, basically, where the bombers have been placed there, it really shows how far Russia's relationship with Iran has progressed. We know that America, especially the Obama administration, has worked hard to build that relationship with Iran, the American relationship with Iran, that is, and they've spent billions of dollars doing it. And here we see Russia almost, it seems, with ease, slipping into Iran. Now, a lot of commentators say that Russia probably paid for this privilege, but the fact is America's put billions of dollars into working out nuclear negotiations and deals with Iran, trying to befriend them and change the relationship, change the norm. And here we see Russia just slip straight on in there and start this historic partnership with Iran. Now, it benefits Iran in a lot of ways. For instance, or especially because of Russia's influence in Syria. Now, as I mentioned, it goes beyond just the simple logistics and the strategic value of having bombers stationed closer to where you're conducting your air raids. This sends a real message to Iran's enemies. When you look at Saudi Arabia and other quote-unquote moderate Arab nations that are working to support the Syrian rebels, even the United States working to support the Syrian rebels, well, we know that the ebb and the flow of the battle in Syria, it varies from time to time. But here we see Iran just stepping up and saying, no, we're ready to depart from these historic norms and these historic trends that we've stuck to for years and years, decades even, we're willing to depart from those if it means preserving the Assad regime. It really shows Iran's commitment to supporting him, to supporting their ally in Syria by allowing Russia in. So this was a very strong message that was sent to these other nations in the region.
This is such an involved situation. We were just talking with Brent about the introduction of Turkey into this theater and how Russia was apparently acquiescent to Turkey's presence there and seemed to be certainly less committed to Assad's preservation than Iran is, but how Iran has much more at stake against Turkey's intervention. It seems like after this happened, this incident with Russia taking off from an Iranian airbase, that Iran was fairly uncomfortable with the way that Russia characterized it in the media and the way that the media reported on it as being this kind of cozy relationship. Iran backed away and said, no, it wasn't nearly as comprehensive, or we're not as cozy as you're all making us out to be. So they definitely were. They were okay with making this statement to some degree, but didn't want it to go as far as what it actually came out to be. Iran's kind of in a precarious situation here.
That's exactly right. And I think that that just goes to show that Russia's goals, its objectives, and Iran's goals and objectives do not run exactly parallel. They might run parallel in a couple of areas, especially towards the replacement of America, or getting rid of America, at least, from the Middle East. But Russia's not just doing this for Iran's benefit. It doesn't stand to gain a great deal from seeing Iran prosper and flourish in the Middle East. It's Russia that wants to replace America in the Middle East.
That's really the way that Iran, you're looking at this. You're looking at this primarily as this was a means by which Russia was able to undermine America's claim to supremacy in the region, and maybe just this kind of a bit of a backhanded insult of America, saying, despite all of the diplomacy and everything that you've been doing to try to smooth things over with Iran, you're still nowhere near the place that we are in terms of our relationship with Iran. And Iran may be something kind of similar to that. It's hard for me to understand how Russia coming into an Iranian airbase would play well on Iranian media.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think that this is a one giant poke in the eye to America from Russia's perspective. We know that the bombing raids, both Russia and Iran said that the raids, they served their purpose. They went on for about a week or so, and now these Russian bombers, they've headed back to Russia. So that just shows that it wasn't really about the bombings themselves. It was about the message that they sent. Now, from the Iranian perspective, it might not play well to on Iranian television to say that we're working right alongside the Russians in supporting the Assad regime. But at the same time, it does send a strong message, as I mentioned, to Iran's enemies in the region, the Saudis and such, they've really struggled with their coalitions, their partnerships, especially with America. In the last year, we've seen that relationship just fracture time and time again. We see these rebel forces fighting each other. And for Iran and Russia to come out in this historically bold move, to work side by side, even if it's only for a week, it speaks volumes, or at least it puts up a facade that this relationship between Iran and Russia, this coalition, or as I said in the article, this axis of evil, it really shows that this is a strong relationship, that it's working well, that they're working towards the same objectives, even if we know that ultimately they aren't exactly the same. Russia wants its own gains in the Middle East, and Iran has its own ideas. But at least in Syria, they're showing unity by doing this sort of thing. Even if Iran might come out and scold Russia on how it went about portraying this in the media and perhaps being a little too arrogant for their liking or publicizing it a little too much. But it definitely shows Iran's enemies that, hey, we're strong, we're united, we've got historic agreements now with our friends in the region, and we're willing to step out and to do these things in the support of Assad.
Well, I just looking at this in the context of the Iran nuclear deal and this kind of renewed legitimacy that Iran has after that deal was made, the way that it's conducting itself with other nations, the way that it's conducting itself with Russia, and the way that it's projecting power within the region, it really does. It is interesting to see this in that context, and the fact that it is so contrary to American interest. America couldn't have been too excited about this happening. But any other broader implications that this incident might have, or anything else that this might illustrate in your view?
Yeah, well, I think that this is going to severely damage America's chances of re-engaging in the Middle East. As they've slowly drawn out, they've left this power vacuum that's been, we've seen, being filled by Russia and Iran. And for America to now turn around and to get more involved in Syria, well, it would mean having to work alongside those who have now been really active in the region for a number of years. So we've seen Russia over the last year really step up its involvement, and they have this agreement with America where they let each other know when they're doing bombing raids and such. Not that that stopped Russia from bombing, you know, the America's allies, the rebels that they support, but they have these agreements where they you know, they try to stay out of each other's way, but go ahead and you know, bomb ISIS or whoever they deem to be ISIS. If America wants to get more involved now, well, they're going to have to work not only alongside Russia, but now also Iran. We've seen Iran really step up its involvement. And with Russia and Iran working so closely together these days, America has no way of getting more involved without looking like it does support Iran in Syria or in Iraq or wherever it might be in the Middle East. These nations, they're working together and building this coalition, and it's a coalition that America, well, it really just cannot join. We see the Chinese starting to move in now, training up Assad's soldiers. We see the Russians in there building their new air base there and supporting the troops and doing these bombing runs. We see Iran's creating these new military groups that it's sending in, not only the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, but this new Freedom Force we heard about this week. So we see these nations that have historically been enemies of America, or certainly very cold towards them, we see them all working together there, and it's not a club that's going to be particularly friendly or conducive for America to come back in.
Yeah, quite the cocktail going on there in Syria. We appreciate you bringing our attention to this dimension, this extra dimension to what's happening there. We've been talking with trumpet writer Callum Wood. He's written an article titled Russia and Iran, the Middle East Axis of Evil. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. We appreciate you coming in, Callum. Thanks a lot.
Thank you again.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It has been said that space is the final frontier, but there's actually quite a lot of undiscovered country right here on Earth, specifically underwater. The deep ocean makes up 80% of Earth's living space, and yet there is so much about it that we do not know. In fact, the Moon, Venus, and Mars have all been mapped in far more detail than the bottom of the sea has. Trumpet writer Richard Palmer is usually neck deep in European geopolitics, but he has a whole lot of other interests as well, including the subaquatic world. We have him here via Skype from our office in the United Kingdom. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So we talked about this discovery, I think, a couple of weeks ago on the Trumpet Hour. I wanted to start by asking you about this Methuselah shark that was just discovered.
Yes, it was just a quick bit we covered in the lightning round that really piqued my interest, was this Greenland ice shark that scientists discovered. That they discovered it has an estimated lifespan of 400 years, which is absolutely mind-blowing. Now, there's a huge amount of uncertainty there, plus or minus 120 years. But even if you take the shortest possible lifespan that this latest study gives the Greenland ice shark, which would be about 280 years, you've got a shark that is older than the United States, which is... it's something that's almost hard to get your head around. And if it's at its longest, then you've got a shark that's 580 years old, potentially. And this is just based on one specimen of this particular shark, or I should say a small sample of specimens. So how long do these creatures live? And, you know, have there just been these sharks swimming in the ocean for almost as long as man has actually been sailing in the Atlantic Ocean?
So this is kind of emblematic of the fact that there's so much down there that we don't know. These kinds of discoveries are happening with some regularity. Maybe you could tell us about some other recent discoveries that show just how bizarre, how varied, how manifold the life down there is.
Well, sticking with sharks, they discovered a brand new shark just at the end of 2015 that was announced. They decided to call that one the Ninja Lantern Shark.
Sounds cool.
Yep, it's a cool name. The lantern shark is an interesting shark. This is a kind of a subtype of shark that glows, that actually lights up. And the Ninja Lantern Shark is kind of like a dark variety of this shark that lives very deep in the ocean. And it's a whole genre of exploration that is really just opening up. Until very recently, we couldn't travel this deep down into the ocean. And then for a lot of these creatures, even if you have some kind of a net and you catch them deep down in the ocean, especially the ones that live really deep, and then you bring them up, they're dead by the time they reach the surface. And a lot of the most unique aspects of their biology you can't see once they've reached the surface, and they've already been broken down and destroyed. And it's only very recently that we've had the technology and the ability to go down into these very deep waters and see what it's like there, and see what these creatures are like when they're actually living and swimming around.
It's got to be pretty cool to be a scientist involved in this discovery and just having so much that is unknown, finding new species all the time, being able to give them names like the Ninja Lantern Shark, and just coming to see things that human eyes have never witnessed.
Right. And then when you start to get really deep down to, say, the very bottom of the ocean floor, this is an area, it's often called the abyssal plain. Once you get down at the middle of the ocean and it's deep, it's just a very flat plain that stretches for miles and miles. And we've explored only a tiny amount of that. By the year 2000, I think it was about 5 miles of this abyssal plain that we'd actually explored. And the abyssal plain covers more of the planet than Earth's continent does.
Mm-hmm.
And one group of scientists estimate that for every square kilometer, that's just a little smaller than a square mile, they would find one new species for every square kilometer of this plain explored. And we've only explored just a handful of square kilometers. So there's a huge amount of potential out there.
What are some of the technologies that are enabling them to begin to map out some of this territory and to find some of these species?
Well, the big thing is just being able to withstand the pressure. Once you get down to the abyssal plain, you start to have incredibly thick sheets of glass on pretty tiny windows, thick amounts of metal, just to stop the submarine from being crushed by all of that water pressure. And then even today, I think there's only a handful of submarines that can even go down that deep. But just to give an idea of how recent a lot of this exploration is, during the First World War, or Second World War, sorry, sonar operators, where they bounce sound waves around within the sea to use exploration, to explore and to spot other submarines, they noticed a really weird effect. And that was, according to their sonar readings, the bottom of the sea came rushing up to meet them every night. And it came, I think it was during full moons, it didn't come, or it didn't come as far. And what they actually discovered was that there is a huge migration, probably the biggest, or not probably, it is, it's the biggest migration on the planet every night, where all these deep sea creatures come up from these murky depths up into the top of the ocean to feed and then go back down again. And it's so big and it's so wide scale that the submarine sonar was picking it up as if it was the bottom of the sea coming up.
That's
so
remarkable.
It's a huge event that happens all around the world. And until about 60, 70 years ago, we had no idea that it was going on. So this is an area that man has just never really been to.
I recently saw a documentary that was talking specifically about bioluminescence and how prevalent it is. The deeper you go in the ocean, you have this idea that it's just a complete blackness. There's no light that can penetrate down there. And yet so many of these creatures actually put on a fireworks show themselves.
This is my favorite part about about this. And as you say, bioluminescence, that's another subject that just within the past 10 years or so, we're learning far more about. I think even not just in the ocean, but even they're discovering now more and more worms under the ground that have bioluminescence. Mm. And that's something they're still trying to get their heads around as to why you would have have worms that light up. But the ocean, I've got in this article that I wrote on this subject for The Trumpet, there are some quotes that I just love from one of the first people ever to go down to these murky depths and see the bioluminescence. And obviously she'd done some work on bioluminescence before then. And this journalist describing, it was Edith Widder, and she was one of these pioneers in this field. And the journalist interviewing her said she was hoping for a flash here, a flash there, but what she saw in the darkness rivaled Van Gogh's Starry Night, plumes and blossoms and flourishes of brilliance. And then when this when Widder was describing what she saw, she said there were explosions of light all around and sparks and swirls and great chains of what looked like Japanese lanterns. I was enveloped. Everything was glowing. I couldn't distinguish one night from another. It was just a variety of things making light, different shapes, different kinetics, mostly blue, and just so much of it. That is what astonished me. So for the thousands of years mankind has been on this planet, there's been this incredible starry night hundreds of feet down in the ocean. And until the past couple of decades, we've known nothing about it.
This is so fascinating to me. Having done some scuba diving, I've always loved being underwater, and just having compressed air on your back that enables you to go down deep enough and being able to have artificial light and turn a flashlight on and look around, you're seeing colors and things that you wouldn't see if you didn't have a flashlight. And I'm sure that people have been doing skin diving for as long as people have been on this earth, but it just strikes me as phenomenal that so much of this has been completely unseen by human eyes, and especially when you're going down deeper than that into areas that it would be absolutely impossible to do without strong submersibles. The fact that God put this life in these places that he wouldn't have expected people to find until here, right at the very end in our day, I think just is extraordinary. We talk about just how much of the universe we haven't been able to see because we haven't had the Hubble telescope and the other very high powered telescopes that have enabled us to see out into the cosmos until just very recently. And we're getting the same kind of expansion of our understanding in the ocean depths.
Yeah, absolutely. And in this article, in the conclusion, that I definitely had some of those same thoughts, and I kind of tried to connect the two, because you know, one of the things we really get excited about when we're looking out into space is we have all of those prophecies that say that God is just going to fill the universe with life eventually, and that's part of the plan there. And then now, as we get to look at Earth more and just get a better idea of how he has filled Earth with life, it really makes you think, well, when God comes to filling the universe with life, and now we're getting a better picture for just the variety of life, the brilliance of it all over the planet, the genius involved in designing the different bits of life, what's it going to look like when the entire universe is filled with life the same way perhaps that the Earth is today?
You know, I think about, say, if are looking at this kind of discovery through an evolutionary lens, and you basically are looking at these miracles and these tremendous creations that are so finely and masterfully engineered, and basically attributing all of that to accidents of nature, you're going to get a very different message from that than if you're looking at it as the product of a creative mind that is really interested in variety, and it's almost like a virtuosity in creation. It's just really exciting.
I love that phrase, virtuosity in creation. And yeah, that's exactly it. And it is sad that we have more proof of a brilliant creator than ever before, and yet more people reject that than ever before. And it wasn't, I mean, before people started discovering all of this brilliant life down there, there was quite a strong body of opinion that said below a certain level, once it got dark in the ocean, there would be no life at all, mm-hmm. that it was just too inhospitable, that once you got to the bottom, there would be nothing there. And now we're finding that that's totally wrong. you know, just it, as you said, just reflects on the brilliance and the virtuosity of the one that created all of that.
To think that a creature would be able to withstand the kind of atmospheric pressure that would crush anything less than, you know, thick steel and thick glass is really quite extraordinary. It makes sense that as their bodies are adapted to that area, or created specifically to withstand that, that if you raise them up to the surface, that you're going to have that it's not going to hold up, that there would be real problems. But it's fascinating to think about these areas where they're finding more and more of the what they call extremophile life, where there are these organisms, even small organisms that inhabit like extremely hot thermal shafts, and you know they're living in temperatures that would absolutely boil any other form of life, and yet that's where they live. That's where they have to be.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why I've been so surprised by a lot of this life is, you know, those animals that are designed to live deep in the ocean, it's a little different in terms of withstanding pressure because they don't generally have to keep any air inside of them, or they're not kind of balancing pressure the same way we are when we go down there. But then, yes, when you take them up into the surface, it would be almost the same effect on them as it would be just to put a human down at the bottom of the sea without any protection. And so some of these creatures that we are finding having this incredible bioluminescence or you know, these incredible features, we've actually known about them before, but we've only ever seen them dead at the surface and never been able to see some of the most exciting aspects and features that they have.
Fascinating stuff. Appreciated you putting that article together. I think it makes a very nice article. We're talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer, and this article is called "The Oceans Declare the Glory of God." It's in the October edition of The Trumpet. That should be posted in a very short amount of time on thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that. And really something that opens our eyes to an aspect of life on Earth that we don't get to see all that often. We appreciate you bringing it to us, Richard.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Love can be expressed in smiles, kind words and deeds, hugs, cuddles, gifts. But did you know that at times it can also be expressed in confrontation and conflict? It can, according to wise King Solomon. Open rebuke is better than secret love, he wrote in Proverbs 27 and verse 5. Think about that. What good is love unexpressed? It benefits no one. You might feel very loving towards someone, but if you don't express it, it does that person no good. You know what's more beneficial than that? Open rebuke. At least then the person might actually profit from what is said. Sometimes rebuke can be quite helpful. Verse 6 of Proverbs 27 says, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy." Yes, sometimes a wound can be faithful, meaning it can support, confirm, uphold, or nourish you. Like the time your friend barked at you to quit your pity party after a setback at work and move on with your life. Are you friend enough to deliver a faithful wound when necessary? If someone you care about is doing something that's hurting them and they can't see it or they refuse to see it, someone needs to step in. The Bible is clear. A Christian cannot fear confrontation. Shying away from it simply because it's uncomfortable is a failure to love someone enough to help them stop hurting themselves or prevent them from making a mistake. If you're a parent, you must confront your children. If you fail to do so, you fail to love them. Read Proverbs 13, verse 24, Proverbs 19, verse 18, Proverbs 29, verse 15. These verses say, if you spare the rod, which is a direct form of confrontation, you hate your son. If you love him, you'll chasten him promptly. The parent who loves his child springs into action when he sees evil. Children everywhere languish under parents who fail to combat society's evil influences on our children with sufficient force, or who just ignore them altogether. You can't neglect a child. Neglect is not confrontation. Nagging is not confrontation. Negotiation isn't confrontation. Godly confrontation means you set firm rules with clear, just, effective penalties, and you follow through with them consistently. Godly confrontation is hard, but consider the alternative. As you sit back, the evil spreads. It can be like a brush fire on a windy day. If you don't stamp it out, it's going to spread. Well, here are three steps for exercising loving confrontation. Number one, be courageous. When the entire nation cowered in the shadow of Goliath, David ran to the battle. Most of us prefer to ignore a problem and to sweep it under the rug. But when it's there, it smolders and it spreads. In these situations, time is not on your side. Don't procrastinate when you know the responsibility is yours. Sprint forward, grab hold of the problem, and wrestle against it. Number two, be crystal clear. If you're going to really help someone, the person has to know exactly what you're asking of him. Once you've stepped forward to confront evil in the life of your child, your spouse, or your friend, make sure you state things clearly. Don't begin to back down now that you're actually eye to eye. Football coach Bill Parcells said, you have to be honest with people, brutally honest. You have to tell them the truth about the performance. You have to tell it to them face to face, and you have to tell it to them over and over again. Sometimes the truth will be painful. Sometimes saying it will lead to an uncomfortable confrontation. So be it. The only way to change people is to tell them in the clearest possible terms what they're doing wrong. And number three, be humble. This is essential to love-motivated confrontation. This should motivate you from the moment you notice something is wrong to long after the confrontation has taken place. Remember that you have sins. You need to be confronted from time to time. Don't assume you see the whole situation completely. And pray for real godly humility. In fact, the process often involves you being corrected yourself. Jesus said you have to remove the beam in your own eye before you can try to remove the fleck in your brother's eye. James 1, verses 19 to 20 say, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man works not the righteousness of God. Proper confrontation requires emotional maturity, self-control, wisdom. If you confront with your own wrath and emotion, your impatience and frustration and bad temper, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. Don't discipline your child with those emotions. They're only destructive emotions. Your only anger should be righteous anger against sin, directed by God and tempered with His wisdom and His mercy. Godly confrontation has to be done the right way. It takes courage, it takes clarity and humility. It requires you to get rid of your pride and frustration and wrong emotion. It requires you to take personal correction yourself. But as hard as the work of godly confrontation is, don't let that dissuade you from doing it when you need to. Don't fear confrontation. Fear the sin, the evil, the suffering that results from neglecting confrontation. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. They are a form of love and a Christian duty. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Brent Noctegal, Callum Wood, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Benjamin Franklin. He that blows the coals in quarrels that he has nothing to do with has no right to complain if the sparks fly in his face. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.